Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, the author of the novel The Good Lieutenant. So I'm introducing the show alone for a very good reason, which we are going to get to. But first, because nothing can be just plain old good news these days, we are recording this episode on the morning of June 24th, and the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade has just come out. This is terrible news. I'm not going to say I'm surprised by it, however. Earlier this month, we did an episode with Shelley Oria and Kristen Arnett looking at what would happen when the court did this. That episode came out June 2nd. The title is Let Me Say It With All My Heart, This Is Such Bullshit. I think that title's pretty good. So I encourage you to check out the episode, and we will, of course, be covering this in future fiction, nonfiction episodes. For this episode, we wanted to talk about something that was less negative. I don't know. I mean, something we were excited about rather than something that we were dreading. An episode that didn't have to have bullshit in the title. The news and the news part of our news and literature podcast has been a monster of late. You know, we've covered gun violence, multiple mass shootings, Supreme Court, war in Ukraine. So we wanted to do something. We wanted to talk about Star Wars. A big new series on the beloved character Obi-Wan Kenobi just had its finale on Disney+. There have been a ton of other new and much discussed additions to the Star Wars canon recently. The Mandalorian, The Book of Boba Fett, Star Wars Visions, all of which I have watched. So we're going to talk about how our lives and culture have been changed by this massive story, which so many people have been following since it first came out in the 70s. And what's going on with it today, which we will all do with our excellent guest, who I'm about to introduce. But, as I mentioned, Sugi's not here. She's always here. I miss having her here. There's a good reason why she's not here. She is getting married this weekend. So if you want to talk about something positive, there it is. We are so thrilled to hear this news. I've known it for a while, but I'm so thrilled to share this news with you. She's getting married to Travis Workman, who wrote the theme music for this show, so he's been involved with the fiction and nonfiction family from the very beginning. I could not be more thrilled for the both of them. They are a wonderful couple, and I think we should all be sending them off into this new phase of their life with our absolute best wishes, joy, and gladness. They certainly have mine. And now I get to introduce our guest. Van Lathan Jr. is the co-host of the Ringer's Higher Learning podcast and the Midnight Boys podcast. He's a former co-host and senior producer on TMZ Live. He is the executive producer for Two Distant Strangers, the 2021 Academy Award winner for Best Live Action Short Film. That film follows the story of a racially motivated police violence against a black man named Carter who gets stuck in a time loop where he tries to get home to his dog but is killed by a white cop every time. He will host... not Carter, but Van, will host the upcoming AMC Network's WeTV 8-part series, Hip Hop Homicides, produced by Curtis 50 Cent Jackson. But he's here to talk to us about the influence that Star Wars has had on his life and on American literature, and to discuss his new book, Fat, Crazy, and Tired, Tales from the Trenches of Transformation. Welcome, Van.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Thanks for being here. A lot of the when I was looking up your bios online, you were saying that you were best known for your work at TMZ, but I am a podcast fan of yours.
Nice.
I first heard you when you were hosting the Midnight Boys podcast, which is pretty new. It started in like March of 2021. Mm-hmm. I think I've listened to every episode that you and Charles Holmes and Jomie the Explainer Adideron and Steve Allman, I'm not going to do all their nicknames, which are part of the show, have done since then. And that led me to Higher Learning, which you do with Rachel Lindsay, and your earlier podcast about The Wire with Jemele Hill. I mean, you're great at this. How did you find podcasting as a form that worked for you?
Thank you very much for the compliment. I started podcasting. I remember the first time I was ever on a podcast was actually it was a friend of mine named Alex Thomas who had a podcast a long time ago. But then after that, I did Charlemagne the God and Andrew Schultz's Brilliant Idiots podcast. And that got a conversation started between me and Chris Moreau over at Loudspeakers Network. That ended up me starting podcasting with the Red Pill podcast, which was on Loudspeakers and TMZ's podcast network while I was still at TMZ. So I did that for a couple of years. And then I started having a conversation with Bill. I started having a conversation with Bill about podcasts and about things that are more squarely within my wheelhouse of interest. Not that I wasn't doing that on the Red Pill, but being under the TMZ banner, there's still sort of kind of things that you have to do to feed an audience in a way.
Right.
So for me, I found podcasting as a sort of alternative to the bites of information and bites of talking that I got to do on TMZ in a longer form way of being able to express myself. And it's something that's really, really been very beneficial to my life, being a podcaster.
I mean, there's an improvisational aspect, you know, that you don't get when you're doing TV. I haven't heard the Red Pill show, but I read about it that you did it. I mean, did you know right away coming into it, like, okay, this is a thing for me, or was it something that built for you as you, like, you know, got used to it?
Well, the Red Pill was very interview heavy. So for me on the Red Pill, there was a little bit of me at the beginning. And then after that, I came in with a guest. Every single podcast, I come in with a guest. There were only a couple of podcasts where I didn't have a guest on the Red Pill. So for me, that was something that I knew I could do, right? I've been interviewing people on TMZ, just asking more questions and having a deeper conversation. Podcasting at The Ringer is a little bit different. For me, you rarely have a guest. People like the episodes of Higher Learning with no guests better. So it's been an interesting experience having a co-host or co-hosts here at The Ringer. In engaging in a conversation with someone that you know and have chemistry with a couple of times a week, once a week, whenever something comes out, to be able to make sure that like you're engaged enough to continue to drive the conversation, but also that you're open enough to what's happening in the conversation to be able to throw in some stuff there to entertain people.
You know, we're going to talk about your new book, Fat, Crazy, and Tired, Tales from the Trenches of Transformation, which I really enjoyed in the second half of the show. But the original idea for us doing this show was to talk about Star Wars and the effect that it has on American culture. The Obi-Wan Kenobi series on Disney Plus just ended. You and your guys on the Midnight Boys did a show on that. There's also been recently The Mandalorian, The Book of Boba Fett, Star Wars Visions, all of which you've touched on. I think Mandalorian came out before your podcast, the Midnight Boys podcast started, but you still talk about it. I mean, all of these things you're talking on Midnight Boys, for people who haven't listened to the show, first of all, you should go listen to it, but it's these four guys talking about these shows and what they meant and what they got out of them. In a way, all this stuff coming out makes Star Wars feel as dominant in American culture as it did in 1977 when A New Hope came out and I drew a portrait of Darth Vader and gave it to my mom for Mother's Day. <You know? laughs> I mean, why is this story so powerful in America?
Oh, man, because it's just insanely relatable.
Yeah.
It's like, look, the thing about Star Wars is it talks about some things the way they are and some things the way we would want them to be. And I think when you have stories that are able to combine those two things and still give what Lucas says is a prerequisite for every single Star Wars piece of art that comes out, which is hope. When you have hope and those two things, people are always going to relate to it. So when I'm a kid, right, I'm a kid, and my first grade teacher, she says that it's Halloween time. and we're all going to come to the school, and we're going to wear costumes. My first grade teacher says she's not going to tell us who she's going to dress up as.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
And we're like, okay. She's like, it's a surprise. You guys are going to all come in your costumes, and then after this, I'm going to come in my costume, and it's going to be a surprise. And we're trying to figure it out for like a week. We're like, is it a good guy or a bad guy? She goes, it's a bad guy, but it's also a good guy. And we're like, oh my God. And we go, is it a cartoon? She goes, nope, it's not a cartoon. And we keep asking over and over and over again who she's going to be. And she comes and she's Darth Vader. Oh. I didn't know who Darth Vader was. I had seen Darth Vader, but I was only 6 years old. I had seen Darth Vader before, right? See him on lunchboxes,
right?
See him on all that stuff. But I didn't really know who he was. I just knew that he was bad. And so I go, what is that? And when I'm driving home, when my dad's taking me home, I said, Daddy, who is Dark Vader? Because I'd say dark when I was a kid. Like, who is Darth Vader? And he goes, oh, that's Luke Skywalker's father. And for some reason, and he ruined it.
Don't get me wrong. That's a little bit of a spoiler from your dad there. What's going on?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, you know what? I take that back. It was my uncle that said that, because he was in the back. My father, I remember watching Empire with him, and my father didn't ruin it for me.
Okay.
Because I didn't really have a concept of who all of these characters were in the first place. So it was still a surprise when I got there, however. So anyway, that started a curiosity. And my father looked at me. He goes, you ain't never seen Star Wars before? And I'm like, no.
I'm six.
And he was like, uh-uh. He's like, we got to do this. He's like, no. This boy, you ain't never seen The Empire Strikes Back? That was my dad's favorite movie. He's like, and I'm like, no. And I started watching it. And I don't know what it was. Immediately, I'm not even talking about the first scene of A New Hope. I'm talking about when the crawl started. Mm-hmm. Up the side, immediately I was hooked. And the more I got to know about the story, the more intrigued I was. I was intrigued by the friendship between them. Remember, I'm from South Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I say this all the time. I'm looking around and it doesn't look like Star Wars. It looks like a dystopian version of American dysfunction. But I'm looking at different planets. I'm looking at different galaxies. I'm looking at people that are endeavoring to fight against things that are trying to oppress them and slow them down. And I'm being challenged intellectually as a kid to understand all of these concepts. I'm being inspired to try to defeat evil in my own way. And I'm also getting a masterclass on how people's best laid plans turn into oppression and fascism. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting it all while I'm getting lightsabers and X-wings, B-wings. I'm getting all different types of alien races, and I'm getting taken out of where I'm from, and I couldn't stop. I haven't stopped ever since. I went into the Legends continuity after the three movies were. I'm like, I want more. I want more. I want more, more, more. And for a long time,
there wasn't
that much. Yeah, for a long time there wasn't that much. Like, and I make fun of Jomi and Steve and Charles all the time because they're getting so much of this content, but dog. Until 99.
I know. Well, the only hard part of your podcast is that they kid you for being old, and you're like 15 years younger than I am, so I always feel like shit when that happens.
But is like there was like I was reading book after book after book after book after book trying to keep up with this stuff, but there were no movies. There were hardly video games. Yeah. There were a couple of video games, but there was a couple of television specials, but then they stopped doing those, and there was just the promise. There was the promise that there would be prequels. There was the promise that there would be more stuff. And then, you know, not until they re-released the updated versions, I think it was like 97, that we see Star Wars back in the movie theater. So they're living in the golden age of it.
That's true. And, you know, I mean, also there's, it feels like, and you've talked about this some on the podcast, that the prequels that were made later, that are about the stories that happened before New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, people didn't like those that much when they first came out. They were not super popular. And now they're starting to have a lot of resonance based on this sort of Obi-Wan story, which is relates back to the relationship between Anakin and Obi-Wan in the past. And there's starting to be, there's sort of a depth to this universe that is quite remarkable. Now, your podcast not only refers to the movies, but also to Star Wars Rebels and to the animated series, which led me to watch them, which I hadn't watched, but they also were available now because they're on Disney Plus, so I could actually just sit down and watch them. So the availability of the content does seem to make a difference. And the, like the way the universe has sort of expanded or filled in the gaps in between the universe, in between time in the universe of Star Wars.
Yeah, so that's an important thing. So when you watch Obi-Wan, and this is the thing about the prequels. I'll come to Obi-Wan in a second. The prequels were wholly different than what we were used to. Okay, what we were used to is a ragtag group of fighters using a mysterious power trying to overthrow this dark fascist government. That's easy. That's very, very, very easy. We see that all the time. We've seen that in actual reality, right? That's easy. You were just talking to me before this about how that actually kind of played out in actual real life, you know what I mean? During a certain time, a dark time in world history, right? So that's an easy story to get people behind. It's a much more difficult story to get people behind this intense political melodrama that has to do with how a republic turns into that empire, which might be happening in America right now. So that's just not as fun to watch. And it's also not as fun to watch a precocious young slave kid turn into the most evil man in the galaxy. All right. It's also not as fun to watch that either. Right. So I don't think people were ready for the tonal shift. Like Phantom Menace for a lot of people was hard to understand. Like George didn't give you any cliff notes. He went right forward, introduced all these new concepts, all these new characters, didn't have Lawrence Kasdan to write characters that are absolutely beloved and have quips. And the galaxy was different. Things were more formal. Things were more elegant. Things were shinier. It wasn't the Star Wars we were used to. So I think we were bombarded with that. And perhaps not ready for it. That's why Revenge of the Sith, in a lot of ways, is so much more loved of a film, because we had kind of two remedial courses in what the new Star Wars universe and how and the old Star Wars universe looked like. And then by the time we get to Revenge of the Sith, you get a pretty cohesive, very important, highly emotional film, more akin to what we saw in the first three movies, right? Because if we're being honest, Star Wars is better when the Empire rules the galaxy. It is. Like it's better when the Empire it just is. It's better when the Empire rules the galaxy. The Empire is the stakes are higher. Now, which brings me to Obi-Wan. In terms of Obi-Wan, the Obi-Wan series, as it relates to all the stuff you were just talking about, is interesting because we know what's going to happen in the Obi-Wan series.
Right.
We know Kenobi doesn't die. We know how. We know where Kenobi dies, how Kenobi dies, and who kills him. Right. We know that Leia's not going to die.
Yeah.
What Star Wars has been able to do is give us arcs inside of these characters that are less fleshed out, that we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen to Ezra Bridger. We didn't know what was going to happen to Kanan Jarrus. These are characters from Rebels. We don't know how Ahsoka Tano's story ends. We don't know how Din Djarin's story ends, The Mandalorian. And so they're able to give us people from that same time period and stories for people we can still root for, while we know how the Empire is destroyed, while we know what happens to Obi-Wan, we know what happens to Luke, we know what happens to Leia. And so being able to fold that in while also saying hello there again to Kenobi is just amazing. And as much as people were divisive on the Kenobi series,
Were they?
I thought it was great.
It was good, but was and I heard you guys argue about it, but it didn't seem like anyone said that it was bad.
No, but with the Star Wars fans, you guys have to understand.
I don't understand. I don't. Well, maybe I'll find out when we get email about this show, but I'm sure you guys get a lot of fan interaction. And in a very negative way sometimes, just, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Like, it's, you have to understand, this is like one of my oldest friends. This is a, Star Wars is a friend I made when I was 6 years old. This is one of the oldest friends I have in the world. There's only one other thing in the world, a person that I met in the first grade too, that's still my best friend, my friend Ryan. But so when you take a shot at Star Wars and when I disagree with something, I'm not disagreeing with you as much as I'm disagreeing with my own childhood. You're a, it's an affront to who I was when I was a baby. You know what I mean? And so I think a lot of times people don't know how to digest some of the relevant criticisms that the Midnight Boys might have, because we're in love with this content as well, but we get paid to talk about it. So there's a different edict. We have to also say, hey, this is good. This wasn't so good. I like this. I didn't like this. If not, then everything is roses and ice cream, and you can't have any type of conversation about anything. And so sometimes that gets us a little bit in trouble with
the Well, too bad for them, because it makes the podcast more interesting. But I would also say that, you know, you're a lot more positive. Here's my criticism I had for a long time. I was a war reporter in Iraq, so I've been familiar with war and think a lot about war narrative, right, and how war narrative works. And one of the things that always troubled me about A New Hope was that it was a very traditional war narrative, which I think are bad narratives, where the young person goes to war, proves themselves to be a man by being in combat, and then gets the medals at the end, right? It's very similar to like American war narratives that come from World War II and which would have been part of, you know, the creator's past, right? George Lucas would have known those. And I think those are bad. I think those are dangerous narratives. And now what your podcast turned me on to was to think about Star Wars as not only that narrative, that was a narrative, but also the narrative about the Republic teaming up with the people who would eventually be the Empire and then getting completely screwed over and ruining things, you know, and the mistakes that the Jedi made, which is part of what Obi-Wan Kenobi is about. That's interesting to me. And that complicates that simplified war narrative that made A New Hope so popular. And so that led me back into thinking about Star Wars in a way that was more complicated and allowed me to enjoy it more. So I appreciate you guys helping me do that.
Yeah, so what you're talking about is central to the destabilization of the galaxy as we knew it in Star Wars, right? Not the entire time. As Darth Sidious, better known as Sheev Palpatine, better known as Darth Sidious, begins to build and manifest his plan to take over the galaxy, he needs the Jedi to help him. Like, they have to help him, or else it won't work. So what you see is a group of people who, the Jedi, right, who are supposed to be beholding to what? The will of the living force. The force is a dogma. The force is like, it's a religion. To a degree, because you listen to and you adhere to the will of the force. And the force is about life. It's about what binds everybody together. So it's not about even democracy. You know, it's not about the Republic. It's not about any of those things. The force is sometimes about fighting. Sometimes the force is about not fighting. To be honest with you, much more it's probably about like resisting your urge to fight, right? But the Jedi lose that. The Jedi become like agents of politics. They become soldiers for one specific person's view of what the Republic should be. And they think they're right when they're wrong.
Yeah.
And so that is just the way people are, my friend. It's just, it goes back to the fact that there's a human element in even our best laid plans that we always end up bumping our heads against. And they didn't see it until it was too late.
So I
Go ahead.
I was wondering how much of this did George Lucas see when he was writing those first movies? Like, this becomes such an interesting narrative I'm not an expert on these things. Did he like know this whole entire narrative? You know, not maybe these interstitial things, but the narrative of, you know, that Darth Vader really was Anakin Skywalker, really was Luke Skywalker's dad. Did he discover that while writing these movies? Was this something that happened? Was sui generis for him? Like started at the beginning.
I think he okay. did. I'll be honest with you. He had a whole story, an entire story. He had 6 episodes of a story, right? And it is said that he decided that the last 3 episodes were the best ones because essentially Star Wars, if you look at it, at least the Skywalker saga is the story of Anakin Skywalker. It's not the story of Luke right. Skywalker. We thought it was the story of Luke Skywalker. It's the story of Anakin Skywalker. First person you see in A New Hope is Vader.
Right.
Okay. And so it's essentially his story, right? But you can't tell me Star Wars is a master class at retconning things. And by the way, this is said.
Now, wait, will you define the cast, just for our listeners who might not know that term, because you use it a lot on the podcast, what does it mean to retcon a property like this?
Retconning means changing changing canon elements of a story, right? So Superman was born on Krypton. Nah, Superman was born on Kansas. He was now from Earth. That's a retcon of Superman's origin.
Okay.
It's when you change the origin or change the backstory of something. So for me, it's a funny story because there's a story about Harrison Ford getting the pages on the plane or before shooting or something about Vader being Skywalker's father. Mm-hmm. And there's a famous line where I think it's either Harrison Ford or Mark Hamill that says, "Did you just make that up on the plane over here?" So I guess my thing is, it's hard to tell because there's a 6-part story, no doubt about
okay.
it. But it's hard to tell which ones of these things. It's hard to tell when Luke and Leia became sisters, and if you watch the original trilogy, really, it's hard to tell when they became sisters because there's a flirtatious kiss in there that's a little icky.
Right. Yeah.
If you're gonna paint these characters as brother and sister. But then other stuff is just the way the story figured itself out. And to be honest with you, if he was to a degree making it up as he went along, which this is a big conversation within Star Wars characters, within Star Wars circles, I actually have more respect for it in that sense because the story that he was able to suss out was so much richer than the one that he might have even started with.
Yeah, to me as a novelist, it makes sense that he would have been discovering these things as they go along because it's really, really hard to imagine all the twists and turns of a story in your conscious mind. It requires some unconscious thought and processing, and you sort of find those plot twists as you're writing something. And so it would make sense to me that he sort of did it as he was going.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I mean, obviously we know that there's still stuff going on because in the last 3 episodes, in episodes 4, 5, and 6, there's no Ahsoka Tano. All of these characters, they're not around. We don't see them in these movies. But then when you watch Rebels, you see them, right? Like you see them, you see what they're doing, you see the Ghost Crew, but they never show up in these huge battles in the movies. But then when you watch Rebels, you see where they were and what they were doing. So you would think that there would be points, or maybe they might come around and lend a hand, but they're not around, and they're not even nobody even mentions them. You never hear Vader talking about his lost apprentice,
right?
You never hear which he had a whole apprentice to himself. You never hear Obi-Wan mention Ahsoka. It's like all of these things that are going on. These are things that have been retconned. And as
how Dooku is
grows,
not mentioned in the earlier movies.
Like right. So like as you see this, it's like they're retconning these things, and it's okay as long as they do it to where they don't completely piss all over what was canon before. I think we should be okay with it.
So in your June 11 edition of the Midnight Boys, Charles says, from the very beginning, Star Wars has been an allegory of how a fascist state can arise. What happens when people start treating others as lesser, start ignoring signs of these things? The entire Trump administration, the January 6th insurrection, which has been being discussed in the House right now, the GOP's current completely made up insistence that Joe Biden's election was fraudulent. All of this seems like the opening acts of a fascist state. I'm not the only person to say this. And I wonder if part of the American attraction to this story is that it contains within it an awareness of Americans' connections to and flirtation with flat fascism. If maybe that's one of the things that has made this story so deeply. And also resistance to fascism, that it has shown that there are ways to resist that element of American life, which has always been there.
Yeah, I think, very well said. I think that part of American consciousness in the DNA of America is this underdog mentality. This mentality that we're fighting against something so evil that's taking hold of the rest of the world, and we are the last line to stopping a wave, whether that be a red wave of communism, whether that be a wave of terrorism, whatever isms are justifying defense budgets of the day, like the isms that exist, that we're always fighting against those things. And a lot of what we're talking about, it's there from the beginning.
Yeah,
right?
But what if the evil's inside of us? That's the idea that I'm getting at.
That's what I'm talking about. And so what I'm saying is that what happens is, and this is essentially what happened in the galaxy, right? Like we believe that in the beginning we were the resistance. We think that we were Skywalker in them. And George Washington was Skywalker, just, you know, had a few more slaves. And all of these people, and you know, and the framers, that they were the sky, that the British was essentially the empire in a real way. But I think what we're real, like what Star Wars really wrestles with to me is, what are people really willing to sacrifice for power and order?
Okay.
Like there's a character in Obi-Wan, right? Freck. You remember him?
Yeah.
He had like the you know, he's the big octopus mouth. He's voiced by Zach Braff.
Who drives the little bus that he turns.
Who drives
him
a little.
Yeah, okay.
Right, he drives a little bus. So that character is very pivotal in Star Wars lore to me. And it was very understated and brilliant how they stuck him in there. We talked about this on the podcast. I'll go over a little bit of what we talked about.
Yeah, explain it, because some people might not have seen this. Yeah.
Okay, so in one episode of Obi-Wan, Obi-Wan and Leia are trying to escape. They're trying to get Leia to a spot where someone can help her get back to Alderaan, because Obi-Wan's been tasked with saving Leia. And they are in this place trying to get a ride to a spaceport to meet up with someone who's going to rendezvous with them, and then take Leia back to her father, who is Bail Organa, a senator that rules over Alderaan. Okay, so while they're doing this, they see this guy named Freck, and Freck comes across as outwardly friendly. He's actually cute in the way that a Star Wars alien could be. He's got a cool Muppet-like voice. He's being voiced by Zach Braff. He seems very upbeat. He offers them a ride, you know what I mean, in a spot where they're doing everything they can to like control what people think, who people think they are. And they get in with him. And when they get in with him, the camera pans to the back and you see the Empire's insignia on the back of his truck. But there's something about the insignia that's on the back of his truck. It's hand-drawn. He drew it. This isn't a flag that someone gave to him and told him he had to put on the back of his vehicle. This is something he took the time to draw and put on the back of his vehicle. And as they talk to him, he starts expressing his affinity for the Empire. He's picking up stormtroopers. They know who he is. He is a sympathizer to the Empire. He likes it. He's saying, hey, nothing wrong with the little order. Things are different around here now that the Empire is around. He enjoys the rule of the Empire. And prior to this point in Star Wars, you hadn't seen very many characters that were, I guess, civilian characters, not involved in whatever was going on, that had like warm and fuzzy things to say about fascist rule. Mm-hmm. And as any society turns into that, those people have to exist. They can't exist without the mandate in some way of a group of people who say, this is how I want it, right? this is how I envision it. Or if the bare minimum is, this is okay. Right?
Yeah.
And so seeing that character, for me, I was like blown away. I was like, man, you mean to tell me this person is not working against the Empire? Everyone doesn't feel lorded over by the Empire. Everyone doesn't feel under the Emperor's thumb. Everyone can't see that the Emperor himself is not about order or freedom, that it's only about what Chief Palpatine says he's about in Revenge of the Sith as he's electrocuting with Force Lightning Mace Windu. He says power, absolute power. That's what he's about. And then I turn around and look at an American society where some of the people who I share my community with can't see that what's happening in certain places in our country isn't about making America better. It's not about making America great. It's about making America how some people want it to be. Like how some people would rather have it. And it's about power and adulation and allegiance to demagogues. And it's exactly what happened in this story that I started following when I was fucking 6 years old. We can't see it. Only we don't have no Jedi. We don't have the Force. We don't have we don't have anything. It's like we're quickly becoming a world without a Superman and a world that might need some Avengers. And watching it happen in Star Wars and watching how they're able to take, and all of this stuff to me is commentary on this as well, to take some of these finer points and wrap them up into this story of intergalactic adventuring is just amazing to me. And that's why it'll never get old.
Yeah, I mean, especially now that we're looking at the, you know, you can see the clear attempt to overturn the rule of law in the January 6th hearings, if you're paying any attention to them. And yet I know when I'm watching them that I have fellow Americans who think that these are bullshit and aren't true. And it's not because they are in favor of democracy. It's because they've ceased to be in favor of democracy. They've gotten to the point at which that bus driver, what was his name again? I forgot his name.
Freck.
They've gotten there. Yeah. There's people in this country, maybe 30%, who are there. And that's a little scary. That seems like a higher percentage than it's been at any other time in my life.
And a louder percentage. Yeah.
So,
you know what I mean? Like higher and louder, yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back. So I've mentioned that, you know, you and Charles and the other guys on the podcast come to this story from a position of what I would call critical love. You know, you love the story and the characters, but you recognize it isn't perfect. And specifically, you and Charles recently called out fans who'd been sending racist messages to the actor Moses Ingram, who plays Reva, the third sister and a member of the Inquisitors in the Obi-Wan series. You said that you fell in love with Star Wars, I got this from somewhere else at age 8, but I guess you were telling me a story about hearing about it when you were 6. So somewhere around there, when you were very young, and that at around 16, you had an epiphany, which...
However old you are in the first grade.
Yeah.
I think you might be 8, 6. I don't remember. However old you are.
My son was young for first his class. So I think I can't remember what he was either. And he's only 13. It's already forgotten how old he was in first grade. And then at 16, you had an epiphany, which was, and as a black man, you could never have made Star Wars. You wouldn't have had the power to create, you know, to get people to listen to and do a story like that. That imagining stories, you said, this is something you said on the podcast, that imagining stories like that was for white people. How has Star Wars operated as a vehicle for commenting on or ignoring race in America?
Tricky question. You have 6 in one, half a dozen in the other. You're going to get 6 people that say Star Wars is really about ignoring that.
Mm-hmm.
Star Wars is about a galaxy where that doesn't exist. It's about lifting the constraints of who and what we are. And looking into a place where people have, you know, light years away, a long, long time ago, where people have all different sorts of problems. And that where, you know, race isn't a construct, where you don't see slavery, where you don't see, well, I mean, there is slavery, but not chattel slavery based on race, where you don't see all of these things where none of these ills have affected them. And that we should put that to the side and free our minds of it as we get transported to this world. That's what some people say. And then there's another group of people that would say, well, we can't help but be acolytes to a lot of the issues that are going on in the world if we don't address them in Star Wars, because they end up playing out on the screen anyway, right? You end up getting a waspy hero every time. You end up getting no representation. You end up getting a galaxy where there are no black people. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or one at a time. You get end up these things that don't exist in Star Wars end up existing in Star Wars because they exist in us. So then how do we combat that, right? Like, what do we do? You know, how do we, what's the right way to go about it? And I'm going to be honest with you. I think we're at a precarious time for that question. I talked about this on the latest Higher Learning. There's a same-sex kiss in the latest Buzz Lightyear movie. Mm-hmm. The kiss was in. Disney heard the belly aching about it. They took it out. All right. Then they heard the belly aching about the kiss being taken out, and they put it back in, and Buzz Lightyear gets released with the kiss. It does $51 million at the box office. That's a Pixar flop, right? That's not good returns on the Pixar movie, especially from a character that's so beloved. Besides the fact that the movie is just okay, but it's not what Disney would have wanted. Now the question becomes from that, if you're Disney, what do you do? All of these corporations are essentially, they're no different than Goldman Sachs. They're about the bottom line and moving money around, really. And that's what they're going to be beholden to. As a group of fans, how do we demand diversity, representation, and really just enriching new and different characters, but also realize that it's incumbent upon us to support these things like way, way more intensely than we normally would. The minute that kiss was included in Buzz Lightyear, everyone should have gone to see the movie. I'm just saying, like, it can't be about tweeting, right? And so it can't be about tweeting and getting mad on social media. Everyone should have gone out to see the movie. Everyone should have gone to see the movie to prove that you don't have to lose to win.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, it's all about money for these companies. So when what happened to Moses Ingram, when it happened, number one, I knew it was going to happen because people don't want Star Wars. They want their Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And when they had their Star Wars as kids, it was one black guy in it. So, and then when they had the prequels, it was one black guy in it. So, like, they don't necessarily want this. And then number two, for me, the reality of not having a place in that galaxy, it became stronger once I became older and I wanted to tell stories. Every story I wanted to tell was about how fucked up it is to be black. Or how beautiful it is to be black, or how funny it is to be black, or how tragic and romantic and that it can be to be black, right? All of these things. Star Wars has nothing to do with that. Star Wars has to do with some other shit. Some intergalactic other shit. And it's hard for me as a black man to think about that. And it will be harder for me as a black man to convince a movie studio that I am thinking about that, right? So I think me understanding the limits of how my situation limits what would be number one, what would exist in me creatively anyway, and then how people would limit my creativity, and then look at the box that Moses was being put in. As she played Reva, by the way, not a good character.
Yeah, I thought you guys did a good job of defending her from being criticized in the manner in which she was, but also talk about how the character is written, which is not the same as what kind of job the actor is doing.
If you don't like Reva, that is fine, but to attack her on a racist or sexist front establishes and reaffirms all of the trepidation that I had about whether or not I could have made Star Wars, or whether or not there would be a place for me in Star Wars, and about whether or not we really are on the same page in loving this stuff. Because when I went to Star Wars Celebration, there was all kinds of people there, mm-hmm. from everywhere. But it just when we get down to the brass tacks of it, which is the actual content, sometimes it seems like people just want it their way.
Well, that's different. I mean, the fans are one subject there, but have the creators? I mean, you know, Lucas is not the guy. There's other people who are involved in this now. Kevin Feige has been very important, and
Dave Filoni.
Yeah, those two men seem to be sort of driving the ship, for lack of a better term.
Kathleen Kennedy is the head of Lucasfilm, so she's going to be probably, I'd say even more than Feige. Feige's coming in a second, but Kathleen Kennedy, the head of Lucasfilm right now, is probably somebody else that should be mentioned there as well.
And I'm forgetting the name. I know the last name. I'm not forgetting the full name of the director for the Obi-Wan series. It was a woman.
Deborah Chow.
That's right. I mean, so how are the creators doing in addressing this issue? It's clear that Lucas was not thinking a lot about this when he was making the original movies, but it seems to me that at least the people who are making the movies now are thinking more about it, but I don't know how well. Like, for instance, I think it's weird that Reva was the character that was poorly written or interesting in the Obi-Wan series, you know?
Yeah, I think it's interesting as well, but I don't think it really has anything to do with whether or not she was black. I just had to think it had to do with whether or not she was needed. Really, all the Inquisitors sucked. Mm-hmm. They all sucked. Every Inquisitor, they did. Every Inquisitor that was in the show sucked. Like, their brother sucked. I can't remember. I don't think it was third brother. Maybe I can't remember which. But they all sucked. The Grand Inquisitor was annoying. You didn't need that you didn't need that thread. If you were going to have the Inquisitors in this show, they should have done it differently. It didn't work. But it didn't work because Moses Ingram was black, and I actually don't think she was poorly written because she was a black character. Okay. I think she was poorly written because that storyline makes no sense.
Well, I come from the position that, and there's a really interesting writer who's, this book is not very well known, but I teach it sometimes in a class I teach on science fiction novels, a guy named Isaiah Lavender, who is like an academic, but he wrote a book called Race in American Science Fiction. And one of the things he talks about is like, there was an original idea in the 70s that has to do with Star Trek, you know, that science fiction was like, we're going to escape thinking about race. We're going to move into the future where race doesn't exist. And this is all positive and really equalizing for everyone. But mostly that was white guys saying that. And that, you know, a more thoughtful way to think about science fiction is that the issues, and like Octavia Butler is a great science fiction writer who does this, right? Is that these issues, science fiction is always commenting on our world. Star Wars is always commenting on America. We've already talked about the ways that it's commenting on America in terms of America's connection to fascism and resistance to fascism. And I think that it always is commenting on race. And when if it's thinking it's not, then it also is doing that in a sense. Right.
Right. Yeah, and I think it has to understand the responsibility.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, I think Star Wars has to understand they have to understand the responsibility. Look, I understand the sentiments of people that go, look, I don't want to have Star Wars, leave it alone. I don't want to talk about it. It's about Anakin Skywalker. By the way, Star Wars, very forgiving. Very forgiving stories, okay? I keep telling people, y'all got to be able to forgive Reva. Anakin Skywalker. If we can forgive Anakin Skywalker, okay? Think about it. I want you to think about something here. You've seen Attack of the Clones, right?
Yeah. A long time ago. It's been a while.
Okay. So in case you guys don't remember, this is pre-Darth Vader. This is still Anakin Skywalker. So his mother, Shmi Skywalker, gets killed by Tusken Raiders. Okay? They call them sand people because they treat indigenous poorly on Tatooine. So Skywalker takes his lightsaber and kills a whole tribe. He says it to Padme. I killed them all. I killed the men, I killed the women, I killed the children. You know what Padme says? Oh, that's so sad, Annie. I'm so sorry you went through that. What's for dinner? What? he just told you that it's in him to like go kill up a bunch of people because he's mad about some other shit. And then the next one, he obviously runs into the Jedi Temple, kills everyone, including the kids in there, right? And three movies later, he saves his son for the Empire, and we give him full credit. Like, like he saves his own child, not another child. By the way, he's a grown man, but not another kid. He saves his own son, and we go, oh, okay, he's not that bad. And he gets a Force Ghost. So if you can forgive...
Well, it sounds a lot like Christianity to me is what it sounds like.
Well, what I'm saying is, cool, just keep the same energy. That's fine. I'm with it, right? I'm with it. Just remember that you have to forgive Reva, too, because she was in the wrong show. So forgive Reva. Like, that's the real, real test of how equal opportunity Star Wars is. We've forgiven a lot worse in here.
All right, so I want to shift to talking about your new book, Fat, Crazy, and Tired, Tales from the Trip.
Do we have to?
Can we?
Because we can, because I'll be honest with you. I love talking about Star Wars.
Well,
I'm just joking.
Your publisher will be very upset with me, I'm sure, if we don't talk about that book. Because I know that my publisher, if I forget to talk about my book, they're very upset with me. But I want to talk about the book because I read it and I enjoyed it. And in the beginning of the book, you say culture is about not just what you eat, but how you eat, when you eat, and what it means to eat. So can you talk a little bit, just to start us off, about what eating and food meant to you growing up in Baton Rouge?
Oh, man. So it's hard for a lot of people to, maybe not so hard for somebody from Kansas City, because you guys care about your food as well. But it's difficult to explain to someone, but food is at the center of our culture. It's the best thing we got. Right? You come down there to eat, and we know it, and we take pride in it. And so how we eat food, when we eat the food, and our pride in it, it gives us this very intimate and sort of almost religious relationship with food, you know, in a lot of ways. It's used to celebrate life. It's used to celebrate death, you know, but in an intense way. You know, everybody gets together and has a little feast when everyone gets together when somebody dies and people bring stuff over. That's not signature to Louisiana, but the question is, how much do you eat? How many times do you eat? And for me, learning early on in my life that you know, it's a story I tell in the book, to where I had an aunt, she's passed on now, but she had moved out to California a long time ago. And when you move out to California, your ability to cook in the way that we cook down there, it erodes. I don't care what anyone says.
Well, you moved to California, so I hope, I'm afraid. Has that happened to you as well?
Gone.
Okay.
Postmates, baby. So it erodes. And one reason why it does is because you don't even have the same stuff that you need to cook some of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't get some of the stuff in California that you need to make a good gumbo. They think that they're doing it, but their gumbo sucks, and I can tell them why. But she was a great lady, my dad's favorite aunt. And everybody at my great-grandfather's funeral was talking about, you know, that her jambalaya was dry. And as a kid, I'm hearing this, and it's funny. It was the first time I think I ever heard adults making fun of other adults. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, stuff that we did as kids, I had never heard. I was told, don't do that, but I'm hearing adults together making fun of other adults. I'm like, oh, okay, so I want to be with them. And so I get a plate and I come back out. My uncles are standing around. I go, man, this is some dry-ass jambalaya. And they burst into laughter. Grown Lathan men burst into laughter. Oh, my God. Y'all hear what Lil Van just said? Blah, blah, blah. And as they're laughing, my dad pulls me to the side. He says, you love your auntie? I'm like, yeah. He's like, you can't never talk about her food that way. I was like, why? She was like, her daddy died. Right? Like, her daddy died, and she made that. She put all of her love and all of her thoughts and her emotions into that food, and her feeding you that food is her way of saying she loved you, and it's her way of saying she loved her family after she lost her daddy. He's like, you wouldn't want anybody making fun of me, making fun of you, if you lost your daddy. And I'm like, yeah. He's like, remember, your auntie loved, this was his favorite aunt. Your auntie loved you, and she shows you by feeding you. I'm like, cool. From that moment on, anytime somebody wanted to give me food, I ate it. Because I'm thinking to myself, yo, if I say no to this next whatever, then I don't love you. And this was like kind of reinforced by my relationship with my mother, who's the best cook in the world, who shows how much she loves you by tinkering with food. She's like the Tony Stark of it. She goes down and she messes around. She tinkers. She finds new stuff, new ways to delight you in that way. And it's also something that never ran from me, and it never runs from us. Everything else in South Louisiana is fleeting. The weather is tumultuous. It might rain for 3 weeks. But if you go to the store, then po' boy is going to be there. This is, we live a very uncertain life. People get sick. People die. It's very stressful. People go to jail. It's crazy. But you can always get a little comfort from what it is that you eat. And so we lean on that. And when I and my weight, when my weight started to balloon, I had never taken into consideration the culture that I came from. I just blamed myself for my lack of discipline. And I think it was incumbent upon me to take a step back and really examine all of those things and let other people examine those things so they can give themselves a fucking break, man.
Well, the book is a lot about that and talking about, you know, how you started thinking about your weight. Can you read a small part of this?
I'm talking about in this that I saw now that I'm in therapy and now that I try to address things, how it was able for me, it was easy for me to go back and analyze how other people were attempting to cope and not deal with certain things. That we would never really endeavor into working these things out generationally or between each other. We would just do whatever we had to do to cope. And sometimes it's anger, sometimes it's drugs, sometimes it's food, sometimes it's sex, but it's never the thing itself. And it's because it's hard to have the conversation, and that's kind of what I'm discussing right here. Okay, so opening up a mental health discussion in the Black community is like opening up a parachute. In general, you only open a parachute when it's necessary. Why would you think about opening a parachute on the ground? We have to repack all of those feelings for nothing if you do that. Remember, discussing our trauma means our camouflage isn't working, and the camouflage is what's been keeping us alive. All this means that once someone sits down with you to talk about mental health, especially a doctor or a therapist, it's going to feel yucky at first. Like, why would I want to talk about my emotional well-being with you? Who are you? And then risk looking and feeling like a total ass when I say something that you couldn't possibly fucking understand because you haven't lived one day with the shit I have to carry around all the time. As a whole society, culture, or whatever, we need to recognize that there's has to be nuance to approaching, dealing with, and providing services for Black people in this country, and in particular for Black men who are struggling with their mental health. Me and my boys talk about everything. Every hurt, every pain, every betrayal. But we never talk about our mental health. Not just how we are, but how we actually fucking feel. We haven't known that we needed to. My homeboys and me have been wearing our trauma camouflage for so long that we can't even recognize our trigger. In my crew, there are womanizers, weed heads, narcissists, and liars, but not one of us knows how our behaviors were incubated. Don't get me wrong. Mental health is about the individual. Something that is this personal should be done on your timetable with people you trust. All I'm asking for you to do is put on your oxygen mask. Don't wait for the progeny lottery. Don't be the one who can survive the punishment. Be the winner. Do the work now. None of us created this, but we have to fix it. So I'll tell you what that's about. So I watched the NBA draft last night. And even though there was something pleasant about it because you didn't see as many hard luck stories, you know, starting to see, it's, you know, maybe things are getting better. But that is always the method to changing a family where I'm from.
Right.
You get lucky. Somebody grows to be 6'8".
That's what you mean by the progeny lottery.
The progeny lottery. Somebody grows to be 6'8". Somebody is super smart. Somebody can sing. Somebody can dance. And then that one person elevates everybody else. And then that is just such a tough situation because it goes wrong so much more than it goes right. It goes wrong all the time. There's a guy right now named Darius Geis who's from South Baton Rouge, where I'm from. Went to LSU, set records, got drafted by Washington, fucked up both knees, and then turned out that the whole time he was at LSU and in Washington, he was treating women crazily and terribly and like shit, and being abusive and rapey and all of those things. At least what it looks like. So he'll never play in the NFL again. He's 23 years old, 24 years old. So the reality of the situation is it wasn't just him. Everybody around the community is disappointed because so many people were riding on that. So many people had their all on one guy who had fantastic ability. And what I'm saying is, those people are always going to be there, and those cases are always going to be there, and they're always going to be outstanding. They'll always be LeBron James. They'll always be, I don't know, some new rapper to come up and change everybody's life. But I'm saying there's little work that has to be done, and that's between us. Little work that has to be done to correct behaviors that don't work in our communities, that don't work for us. And we have to be committed, as committed, to nurturing the non 4-3-40 yard dashers. Right. We have to be as committed to nurturing not even the people that are going on to become doctors, engineers, and lawyers. I'm talking about people that just want good jobs, librarians and mailmen and people that make the society actually go.
Right.
I'm not talking about, hey, go be a lawyer, go be a doctor. I'm talking about, I always look at people, I'm talking about, what about the mechanics? What, like, seriously, a good job, a good paying job that you can make a lot of money doing, right? That you work, you have a great life, send your kids to college or don't send them to college. Maybe they become mechanics. I know families of mechanics that's balling. What about mechanics? What about electricians? What about plumbers? What about all of these? We have to be able to cultivate that too. And in order to do that, we need functional households where people have choices, and we have to address our trauma in order to have that.
I mean, one of the things that you write right after the passage that you read was, we've been tricked to believe that a full belly is more important than a full heart. I thought that was a really important line. And it reminded me back to the beginning of the book where you're talking about the way food was, what is it? A kind of blanket that you used to comfort yourself?
Taste blanket.
A what?
Yeah. Taste blanket.
A taste blanket, right? That you would do that to prevent yourself from thinking about or dealing with some of the things that you're talking about in the passage that we had you read. So food becomes this really important organizing image in the whole book. Was that your original conception? How did you come to that as a way of organizing the book?
Oh, no, it definitely was, because it's been a prevailing theme in my life and in the life of other people that I know. You know, people always say, why don't you just do it? Why don't you just fix it? Why don't you just eat right? You know it's diabetes. You know that it's heart disease. You know there's all of these things that are taking a part of your community. Why don't you just deal with them? And the answer is, we just want to feel okay. At least that's what I've seen. We just want to feel okay. Like, these things taste good. They make us feel good. Some of these different things, the drugs, they ease the pain. Like, we just want to feel okay. You get... it's almost like forced hedonism. Like, you get, it's not like you have everything at your disposal and you just go, I'm just going to go experience every part of pleasure that I can. You know, it's actually, I really don't have a lot going for me.
Right.
Let me experience whatever pleasure I can. Mm-hmm. And we know how to cook, and Popeyes is cheap. And so sometimes it's about not having healthy options, and sometimes it's about living in food deserts, and sometimes it's about all of these other things, but sometimes it's just about our inability to properly define what a good life actually is, and what physical peace actually is, and how that can actually enhance your life. Why? If eating kale is not great, why would I do it? Well, actually, you know, kale... Kalika makes kale, and the kale is bomb. Kale, like, Kalika makes a mean kale. But, like, why would I do it? Like, why would I do it if it doesn't feel good? Because your feel good comes from a place that's, like, instantaneous. But there are other feel goods. It feels good to go on a hike. It feels good not to be winded. It feels good not to have aching joints. All of those things feel good, too. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you can't see them. They're not right in front of you.
Well, you know, books exist because things that we say, and everything you're saying is brilliant and makes a lot of sense to me, but we feel them in books in a way because they're more complicated. And to feel the argument that you're making within the book that you wrote was really powerful. So thank you for that. And thank you for this conversation. We want to encourage our listeners.
Thank you.
Yeah. Everybody go out and pick up Fat, Crazy, and Tired, Tales from the Trenches of Transformation, and check out Van's podcast and his film, Two Distant Strangers. We'll be linking to all these in our show notes. Van, thanks so much for talking to me. I am a fan.
Oh, thank you very much. I hope to come back, man. This was actually a great conversation. Thanks for letting me drone on. It was actually fun talking to you, man. I enjoyed it too.
All right. That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Ann Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel, and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!